House Healthcare Committee for Monday, February 27th, 2012, will now come into session. And we're missing a few people, but this is an informational hearing. It is being taped, and the missing people will get the video. And hopefully, this is the last Healthcare Committee meeting of this session, knock on wood. And I know that's going to be disappointing to all of you, but we will be back in January for our prime time run. So,
be back anyway. Before that.
No, we'll be before that.
Well, we'll be back, yeah, right. I'm talking about session. Okay, first up today, we have an informational meeting on the presentation, our presentation on utilization of doulas in the state medical assistance program. And we are honored to have Representative Kotek here today to introduce the concept. As if she has nothing else to do today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44. I will be brief. First of all, I just want to thank the committee and the co-chairs. I know your schedule has been rather packed, and we are closing in on the end of session, and I'm really glad you're able to do the informational today to hear back from stakeholders about House Bill 3311. That was the bill we had last session to talk about. How do we look at improving the birth outcomes for pregnant women and their children here in the state, particularly on the Oregon Health Plan? And I have to say to the folks you're going to hear from, they have worked really hard since end of session to really look at the issues of doulas and the services they provide and look at the data. And I have in front of me the report that you're going to be reviewing, and I just want to read one section from the executive summary because I think it's the crux of the issue for me. It says, and because of the bill that you passed last session, that we passed, we were able to look at data differently for the first time. And the report says, the Oregon Health Authority data clearly demonstrates a consistent pattern of disparities in birth outcomes between women of color and the non-Latino white population, regardless of geography or payer. As Oregon's population grows and diversifies, it is essential that these disparities be addressed. What I love about this report and the work that's gone into it is we do have some solutions. You're going to hear about the evidence around doulas, what we can do to improve their access to women, particularly on the Oregon Health Plan, but even more so in the entire private sector, because I think what we want to do ultimately is make sure we have the best outcomes possible for women when they're giving birth. So I just encourage your rapt attention. I want to thank you for having the informational today, and thank you. And hopefully we'll be back in 2013 continuing to discuss this topic. So thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Okay, we will call Tricia Tillman, Shafia Monroe, and Emily.
Okay.
There's one more letter there that I was used to putting my mouth around. If you please identify yourselves as you present, and you may start whatever order you want.
Great. I'll start. Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick. It's nice to be here again today. My name is Tricia Tillman, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Equity and Inclusion in the Oregon Health Authority. And first of all, I want to thank you and Representative Kotek for your leadership on this issue. This has been a great opportunity for us to understand more fully about a healthcare workforce that I don't think we've paid enough attention to. Last year, you and the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 3311. The Oregon Health Authority, as a result, was directed to explore options for providing or utilizing doulas in the state medical assistance program to improve birth outcomes for women who face disproportionate risk of poor birth outcomes. And so we were asked to answer three questions, which we will provide an answer for you today. The first was, who are Oregon's most vulnerable mothers? What are doulas and what are promising doula models? That's question number two. And the third question is, what options exist for providing or utilizing doulas in the state medical assistance program? So I'm just going to talk briefly about the process and then let the co-chairs of that committee provide the content of the report. So to complete the work, the Oregon Health Authority's Office of Equity and Inclusion, which formerly was the Office of Multicultural Health and Services, convened a committee that included OBGYN providers, doulas, and a Medicaid managed care organization to answer that those three questions. And two are here today, and then another two are in the audience as well. So I want to thank them for their time. The process we used included reviewing state birth outcomes data, published research, so nationally peer-reviewed research, programs currently utilizing doulas both in Oregon and across the country. And then we also conducted a brief survey of practicing doulas in Oregon. So now I'm going to turn the presentation over to our committee co-chairs to share the findings. Shafia Monroe is the Executive Director of the International Center for Traditional Childbearing, and then she will be followed by Amelia Pismite, Director of the Breastfeeding Coalition of Oregon.
So also, thank you. I'm very excited to be here. We came last year with some community members excited to do the research, and now we're happy to come back again and say we found some good news to share for the state of Oregon. So thank you for your time. So my question is, who are Oregon's most vulnerable moms? The Oregon Health Authority data clearly demonstrates...
Excuse me, I get you to put your name on the record, please.
I'm sorry.
Okay.
Shafia Monroe, Executive Director, mother of seven, grandmother of six. So, Oregon Health Authority data clearly demonstrates a consistent pattern of disparities in birth outcomes between women of color and the non-Latino white population, regardless of geography or payer. So the indicators that we analyzed included comparison of the following racial and ethnic populations compared to non-Latino whites, so Hispanic/Latino, non-Latino black or African American, non-Latino American Indian or Alaskan Native, non-Latino Asian, non-Latino Pacific Islanders, non-Latino multiple race. We disaggregated the above-mentioned racial and ethnic populations by those with Medicaid paid birth and those with births not paid by Medicaid and those who lived in urban and rural areas. In each of the categories, racial ethnic populations are compared to their white counterparts in the same category. So the following were some of the indicators used to determine the birth outcomes. We used premature birth as a measure, low birth weight, cesarean delivery, Apgar score, and then the numbers of babies who died before age one, infant mortality. So I'll go on to question two, if that's okay. And that question is, what a doula is and what are promising doula models? So a doula is a certified professional who provides personal and non-medical support to women and families throughout the woman's pregnancy, during the childbirth and postpartum experience, mentions the scope of the practice of a doula. And also the word doula is a Greek word and it means woman helper, a woman supporter. Based on research reviews, doulas are likely to be they're likely to be a strategy to decrease health inequities in Oregon's birth outcomes. Significant literature suggests that doulas would be an overall strategy to improve birth outcomes funded by both Medicaid and private insurance. The Cochrane Review's findings is telling us this. Several models across the country show promising use of doulas specifically to address inequity in birth outcomes as well as including the ones in Oregon. So the model that we looked at was the Minnesota Truda Women's Project, which is a culturally specific doula project which was created in 1999 to improve healthy birth outcomes and reduce infant mortality disparities among American Indian women. So from 2002 to 2010, this culturally-based doula project expanded to serve additional women of color, Latina, African American, African immigrant, and Asian women, as well as Caucasian, and it became known as the Community Doula Project. With this finding from the United Way Minnesota Department of Health Eliminating Racial and Ethnic Health Disparities Initiative and a third-party billable contract with the UCare Minnesota's fourth largest health plan, the American Indian Family Center operated this multicultural program focused on achieving the following outcomes for women and their families. Healthy birth outcomes, healthy prenatal care, increased awareness of parenting role, as well as health education, and they improve the service integration for women and their families as a whole. So within a six-year period, over 150 ladies of color were served, including American Indian women, and they were trained as doulas. And on the average, the program served 120 to 140 women per year, with over 90% of babies born at above birth weight, which is 5 pounds, 8 ounces. And they also breastfed at 85% success rate. So I believe... Thank you.
Can I ask what that number would be expected to have been without 90%? It means 10% were not...
The 10% that were below the normal birth weight?
Yeah, what would that normal, what would that number usually be?
Yeah, we'll have to get back to you on that because they were looking specifically at women at higher risk. So I'm not sure exactly what that was reduced to.
What the expected was.
Right.
Thank you.
We'll get back to you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Thompson and Co-Chair Greenlick. For the record, I'm Amelia Pismyth. I'm the Director of the Breastfeeding Coalition of Oregon within the Oregon Public Health Institute. I want to commend the Office of Equity and Inclusion for their great job convening a really large group of people around a very complicated set of conversations in a really compressed timeline. They did a great job synthesizing all of that into the report that's before you. So my job is to talk to you about the options that we found for providing or utilizing doulas in the state medical assistance program. So, of course, our committee did its work cognizant of the larger moving conversation, very complicated conversations around healthcare in our country. And so we know that a lot of that's a moving target, but we did all of our work with the eye towards what was going to be a true public health model of prevention and also looking at how to get at cost savings. So we believe from our findings that doulas could be integrated into Oregon's medical assistance program in similar ways as community health workers and peer wellness specialists. So, for example, presently, community health workers do home visits for children with asthma, and peer wellness specialists do home visits around behavioral health and addiction issues. So these are some of the systems that are currently in place in limited ways. And from that, if we created a similar kind of model around doula care and support for birth, we expect that this would result in healthier births for women and their children, while also mitigating the long-term costs associated with poor birth outcomes. Several aspects of establishing doulas as a provider type for Medicaid already exist. So this is the great news. If we wanted to look at this, we already have a lot of the criteria that we need. It's already defined. There are nationally recognized certifications. We know their scope of practice. We know their training. And we have provider and billing codes. This would all ease the process. So because the committee asked us to look in particular at Oregon's most vulnerable mothers, we found that cultural competency was a very necessary component of however we define and implement doula care in the state of Oregon. So we spent quite a bit of time as a committee discussing what that would look like and how do you take all of the people already serving as doulas and make sure that they get what they need to be providing care that's culturally competent, as well as how do we bring on new doulas to make sure that that type of training is integrated. And our recommendations about that are also in the report. So Medicaid reimbursable activities for doulas could be overseen by qualified health professionals. Defined scope of practice for a specific type of worker and documented in the patient's medical record. So for example, hospitals already receive bundled care for most births, and so the recommendation could be that doulas are part of that team and it just becomes, you know, part of the bundled care of services that are already standard. So research suggests that financial benefits may exist relative to doula models related to their connection to maternal preferences and patient satisfaction, improving breastfeeding initiation and continuation rates, increasing the probability of uncomplicated vaginal delivery without analgesia, decrease the operative vaginal delivery and cesarean delivery rates, decrease the use of neonatal intensive care units, which of course are very, very expensive and costly, and admissions based on low APGAR scores, and decreasing repeat C-section morbidity and mortality. So further research may demonstrate that the low-cost, effective, and preventative care of doulas has great potential to improve the health of Oregon families and reduce state health care expenditures. And very simply put, doula care is a place where an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of very expensive cure. Any questions?
Any questions from the panel? One of the...
I was just wondering, how many certified doulas do we have in Oregon, approximately, or do you know?
Our organization, we actually train and certify doulas. So we have about 25, but statewide, I would say there's at least 150.
Okay, thank you.
Can you go?
I was just going to say that a little known fact is I was trained as a doula, 1982,
okay, good.
I think. And have attended many births as a doula. I think it's a fabulous profession. So really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
That's exciting to hear that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You can hear me certify in case we have any emergency delivery.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed recently in two or three different reports, there seems to be a trend nationally for women to elect to give birth alone. Is that a cultural issue, economic issue? What might be driving that? And to me, it seems like a relatively unsafe decision. But
Co-Chair Thompson, are you talking about women who choose to have babies by themselves?
Yes.
At home?
Yes.
Okay.
With no attendees.
Right, right. So that is a new movement that a lot of women experience because of the cost, because Medicaid doesn't pay for a lot of the services for midwives, so they can't afford to pay, you know, up to $8,000 cash, so they are doing it, they call it unassisted birth, which is different from having a doula in a hospital.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're trying to get women to consider not doing that.
As a former medic, it just seems like a very, very questionable thing to be doing. I would rather have the television repairman or anybody there. When things go wrong, they go wrong quickly. Anything else? Okay, thank you.
And, thank you all so much for your time.
I'm sure we'll have more discussion on this topic as time goes on.
And you just want to in support?
Oh, okay. Go ahead right now, yes.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, the collective health advocacy for rooted Latinas and or Africans just submitted written testimony in support of the report and of the bill. We only have one copy, but we will place it out on for your viewing post-meeting.
Thank you very much. Okay, we will close the informational meeting on doulas, and I will open a presentation on health insurance in Oregon, the 2012 report. It's one of the most fascinating pieces of literature I've seen in a long time.
We'll sign copies for you.
Okay, thank you.
Spine's not broken on that.
When is the movie coming out?
Yeah. We're negotiating rights now. Can't talk about it.
I think it is one of the fascinating pieces of literature I've read, actually.
This is the second one. I wore out my other one. So. You just introduce yourself, please. And
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Allen. I'm the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined by Lou Savage, who runs our insurance division. We're happy to be able to spend a few minutes today presenting to you about our 2012 report on health insurance in Oregon. Before I turn it over to Lou for the bulk of the presentation, there are just a couple of key themes that I'd like to hit. This is our sixth such report. For those who aren't familiar with how we regulate health insurance in Oregon, about a third of Oregonians get coverage from insurance companies regulated by us. Regulated by us in some fashion means small employers, large employers, and individual policies. The remainder of that two-thirds are made up of large self-insured companies who are regulated differently, federal folks who receive their health care through federal providers, Medicare, Medicaid, and then the uninsured. The uninsured represent about 17% of the Oregon population right now. About a third of that third, or 11% of Oregonians, get their health insurance from insurers who we also regulate rates. That larger pool, we regulate the financial soundness of the insurance company, terms and conditions, forms, and those kinds of things. But it's 11% of Oregonians' insurance comes from those for whom we provide rate review, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Many insurance companies, one of the highlights of this year's report is that many insurance companies reported lower health care, lower medical claims costs this past year. We think that this is largely a function of economic conditions having an effect on utilization, having an effect on people's ability to pay copays, those kinds of things that would tend to drive down not demand for health care necessarily, but ability to pay for health care having an effect. Despite the slow recovery from the recession, the state's seven largest health insurance companies remain financially viable. In 2010, the seven largest insurers averaged a 3% profit, most of that came from investment income rather than actual underwriting gain on health care provisions itself. October of 2011, we began conducting public hearings on rate review requests. This is a process that's continuing now, for which we've received a federal grant to help us improve and beef up that process. Lou will talk some more about that as well. We've created a rate review public website, OregonHealthRates.org. As a place where we post a huge amount of information about rate review requests. We're also beginning now to do live streaming of the rate review hearings to try to improve accessibility and transparency. With that, I think what I'd like to do is go ahead and turn to Lou, who can give you an overall presentation on some of the details in the report. Lou?
Chair Thompson, members of the committee, Lou Savage, I'm the acting administrator for the insurance division and the senior policy advisor for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. We brought along our website because we wanted you to know that we heard both from this body and from members of the public how important it is to have information about health insurance issues. And the grant that we received from the federal government was useful in allowing us to put this together. We have a lot of information on it, and we're hoping that people will make use of it. And in fact, they have over 1,000 visits a month, and it's actually increasing.
I thought that headline at first glance said health insurance heat review. Oh, that's a new.
So this is the most recent piece. And it's financial data, and I will I'll go right to that now. So this talks about various pieces, and I'm going to go over here right
now. Mr. Chair,
this is the market share.
Blue. Go back. Will you, before we got some time, explain that 11%?
Oh, shucks.
What among the plans you reviewed, you did not review the rates, and why is that?
Oh, okay.
I don't know the answer is why. But.
Sure. Let me go back to hang on here.
There.
Where we go here?
No.
You're asking.
You just had a minute.
If I may, Co-Chairs, your question is why do we only review rates on 11% of?
What is? Yes.
Okay. Well, it's statutory. We review individual and small group plans, and that's by statute.
And by statute, that limits it at 50 employees or fewer.
And all we need to do is change the statutes to include the rest? Is that the...
That would change our review process. And as a matter of fact, the federal act will change the definition of small group to include up to 100.
So under the federal law, you automatically are going to move another percentage.
Yes.
So it's only the over 100 groups that you don't regulate.
Correct.
That we won't for rate review. That's right.
So, thank you, Representative Greenlee. You got me to the right page too. The point of this is just what you asked. These are the plans that we actually can rule on the rates. And the other thing you ought to know is that in fact the small group and the individual market has decreased slightly since the last report. And the
excuse me, are these slides different than the ones we have?
They seem to be.
Yeah. They should not be.
Okay.
They have a PowerPoint. You're showing information that's on the website.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I mean, the information should be the same.
We have a book.
The PowerPoint.
And we have a PowerPoint.
And excerpts from the public website.
And excerpts from the public website, exactly. But it's just a different way of showing the same information.
This is what he's got up there now.
What is that?
So if you want to take a look at the decrease in the number of individual plans, that's on page 38 of the report. If you want to take a look at the decrease in small group plans, that's on page 42 of the report.
Okay, 38 and 42.
So self-insured employers. As Pat mentioned, we don't regulate self-insured employers. However, they are regulated by ERISA, the federal law that would regulate self-insured employers as well as pension plans. The federal programs are Medicare and Medicaid, and they cover a significant number of folks in Oregon. And the uninsured breaks down this way. As you can see, the largest group of uninsured, significant, is the 19 to 64-year-old population.
Where is this data from?
A variety of sources.
When? The uninsured? What's the date?
Oh, I can tell you. I believe it is from this Uber?
Yeah,
okay. Uber 2010. The information that we receive on profit was something that we thought people would be interested in, and this is combined profit. And when we say profit, we also mean income over revenue, because a number of the insurers are not for profits. So as you can see, in 2010, the average profit for the largest insurers in Oregon was 3%. But over the years,
I'm afraid I'm getting confused, and I'm pretty familiar with the data, so I'm not sure you're helping our committee understand.
Okay.
Do we all have this with us, or could you go back to this that you passed out?
Let's go through the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Bring some more data out, it'll make it a lot easier for us. You're following?
I'm a little dumb today.
You're on the internet.
I'm with Mitch.
I can't see this. Slice
yeah, again, the information is the same, but we can do that.
Did you pick up here?
Yeah.
Did we loan you this report that you distributed?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You reference it?
Yeah.
Well, let's start with that. And then
yeah.
We'll
yeah, if we can. I apologize for the confusion. I think what we've tried to do is provide you too many ways of looking at the information.
Three is enough at one time.
Confusing
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, what I think we can do, if we could ask the assistant to give us the to give us the PowerPoint, which is on.
It's right.
Yeah, in your documents.
You don't have it in front
yes,
of
if you in your documents, if yeah. you go to the page that's right. medical loss ratio, I think that'd be a good place to start and get on the same page.
Anywhere you want. Let's
right.
just get us on the same page.
Because when we talk about insurance rate review, this is probably one of the most salient factors. This is the page that displays for you the portion of insurance premiums that insurance companies pay on health care. And so this is driven by health care costs, not by other factors that that drive insurance company financial performance, like investment income, administrative costs, and those sorts of things. The federal government has set a standard of 75% for medical loss ratio as a floor, and when the Health Care Act is fully implemented, companies that fall below that pay less than 75 cents of the insurance premium dollar for health care will be required to engage in rebates back to their premium payers. The punchline here is that in Oregon for 2011 we averaged 89 cents on the dollar going to health care. That's a long-term average, around 89 or 90 cents on the dollar, and it's uniform largely across various providers, as you can see in that table. And so this is an area that's causing a lot of consternation in other states, largely because we've got such a competitive health insurance market in Oregon. This, I think, helps you see that a lot of the money goes to health, large portion of the money goes to health care, and this isn't an issue where the federal standard is going to have, we think, a huge impact on Oregon companies and on premium insurance payers.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll use the PowerPoint. I think it's a lot clearer. Okay. In the process of talking about this slide, so this is net income to premium earned, and we use the word profit, but as I was saying, a number of the largest insurers are in fact not for profit, so that would be actually surplus for them.
Can I ask a question on this?
Sure.
When you take LifeLite as an example, because they were the lowest on the loss ratio,
yes,
and also relatively low here, what happened to the other 19%? The difference between 78, which would have left 22%, and 3 here. So that 19% administrative costs, or what's the difference between?
We're talking about this slide?
He's looking at the slide.
I'm talking about the slide. I'm forced to use the ones in front of me.
Sure.
Right, right. It's
so
the same one.
I have one that talks about loss ratio.
Right, medical loss ratio. Correct.
And on LifeWise, the medical loss ratio is 78%.
Yes.
The next slide, their profit is 3%.
Yeah, where the rest of the money?
What happened to the other 19%? Does that mean that they have a 19% administrative cost, or is there other things?
Do you need all that copy?
Yes, 19% that didn't go to to medical costs.
Okay.
Yeah.
And didn't go to surplus. It went somewhere else.
Right.
Administrative costs, investment performance, underwriting costs.
Right, and
okay.
So
we'll see it in some other slides, I think.
Yeah. So investment, they ended up with 3% in investments.
And 1% in underwriting gain or loss.
Right.
Where did the rest of it go? Still 16%. Is this a hard question for you?
Well, we didn't come prepared to talk about their specific performance in detail.
No, I just picked that as anyone. Pick any other line.
Right. No, that's the point, though, is that those are the components that go into that cost, would be those functions of administrative costs, profit, underwriting losses, investment gains and losses.
The sister's the bottom line.
Are there other significant components?
No, I mean the administrative costs would cover most of that.
So the underwriting gains and losses are the actual premiums themselves. The investments, which we do look at when we review rates. As part of overall profit, and as you can see, they overall in 2010, companies have done much better on investments than they have on premiums. The drop in medical claims has been pretty significant, and that's, one of the reasons why insurers have actually done better in the last year. So we thought it would also be useful for you to see an update on the market share that insurers have. Regions has a large share of the individual and small employer market. And getting back to the front page, I wanted to talk a little bit about our rate review process as well. And I know that we've spoken about this before. We have done hearings for every rate review that we have been responsible for since the middle of 2010, and the process itself has aided in the insurance division's review of the requests. The website itself gives individuals an opportunity to review the documents submitted by the insurers, comment on the requests, and see the communication between the insurer and the division as the process moves forward. And ultimately, the decision and the rationale for the decision is posted on the website. So if there are other questions, be happy to answer them.
Co-chair, if I could come back to Representative Greenlick's question. I think if you look at in the actual report document itself, if you go to page 31 and 32, what you find, I think, is really the question you were getting at, which is what makes up the rest of the 89% whatever the difference between medical loss underwriting and premiums are. And this breaks it down by company to show you how much goes into medical loss ratios, general administrative expenses, claims adjustment expenses, underwriting gains and losses and investment, and those items are the components of what makes up the whatever the percentage is for the individual company. I think that Representative Greenlick gets at what you were trying to find.
You're on page 31?
Starts on page 31, goes through page 33. There's a table for each of the seven largest insurance companies, and it shows the percentage for each of those categories of premium dollar going to, for instance, general administrative expenses, underwriting losses, and so on. And so for each company, those categories should add up to 100%.
What is claims adjustment?
that's basically the cost it takes to go out and settle claims. And so things like identifying what caused a loss to determine if it's related to workers' compensation or automotive policies or those kinds of things would be part of what I believe would go into claims adjustment expenses.
Mr. Chair, may I follow a little further? I'm
Absolutely.
Sorry.
Yes.
Well, I'm just trying to get us a sense of what generally makes up the premium.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm trying to do here. And I just picked LifeWise because it's a particularly interesting one. But they would say that their administrative expense is 13%, right, looking at Table 3.7, 3-7
uh-huh.
on page 31. And then there's this thing called claim adjustment, which their number is 8%. So somehow the 13 and 8 is 21% is what would seem like an administrative cost, but that somehow it's not. Is that right? That's not a part of administrative cost. It's not a part of medical claims.
It's not a part of medical claims, Chair Thompson, Chair Greenlick. You or I probably colloquially would think of that as an administrative cost, but it's called out as a separate category that they're able to categorize those expenses into.
You ever ask them why they're 8% and everybody else is 3%?
Anytime an insurer asks for a rate increase, we do a comparison, but it's not comparing apples to apples often because the groups that they insure and their expenses vary depending upon what the group is, the size of the group, and the administration costs associated with that.
Anything else? Yes.
So in medical loss ratios, and I think you've already answered this, but I want to make sure that I understood. In medical loss ratios, none of that category would be consumed by the insurer. That's actually money that they paid out to a healthcare provider at some point. Is that a correct statement?
It captures that percentage that they paid out.
Correct. The percentage of every premium dollar that they take in is paid out, but it is not consumed by the health insurer and somehow put into medical loss ratio. The medical loss ratio would represent money that is paid out of the insurer to healthcare providers for medical claims.
Chair Thompson, Representative Conrad, that's correct.
Okay.
For LifeWise, that's 78%.
Right.
78 cents out of every dollar this year is going to pay medical claims.
And Chair Thompson, Representative Conger, and Chair Greenlee, we actually when we see that percentage, we ask them what they're doing with that. I mean, we actually look at administrative costs and what the company is doing with that, including improvements to the healthcare system, to the insurance that they regulate, that they provide.
May I follow up on that?
Please.
So, to what extent would capital investments, say a new software system? I'm spitballing here because I don't know this industry particularly well, but something of significant cost like that, but that actually will have long-term, is a long-term need, so it's capital investment. To what extent does that get represented in the overhead? Is it expensed like in a typical depreciation way in the administrative expenses? Is that the way it's handled?
Mr. Co-Chair, as Representative Conger, it is part of the administrative expense. They can include that as part of the administrative expense.
How much of it? If they spent $10 million on a brand new software backbone or something, would that all $10 million come in administrative expense at once?
It'd be depreciated.
Yeah, they're subject
exactly
to the
my question.
Yeah, co-chairs, Representative Concord, they're subject to the same accounting standards that any other business is, and so they first, you know, have to make a determination of if something can be capitalized or not, expense or not, what kind of a depreciation schedule is on. But then once that's occurred, then it feeds into the resultant actual this portion spent this year or accounted for this year goes to administrative expense.
So am I correct in assuming that these then are GAAP type financials that they're representing to you, generally accepted accounting principles?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Conger, that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Doherty?
Okay. The question I have deals with the medical loss ratio, a slide that you have. And I just looked at the year-to-date for this year. Why is there such a gap where you've got Kaiser paying 95% of, on an average of what they bring in towards medical costs, and then you've got one that's down to 73% or 78%? What's the difference?
Mr. Co-Chairs, Representative Doherty, Kaiser has much more control over its costs because it has its own hospitals and clinics.
It's their systems. So.
Right. Okay. And if you look at Providence, it's pretty high as well. They also have much more control than some of the other insurers. The more they can control costs, mm-hmm. The larger that number is going to be.
For example, in their hospitals.
Exactly.
Okay. Makes sense.
Anyone else?
Sure. Before we leave this topic, could I point out to my colleagues page 6 and page 7 of the book, if everybody has it. Because it really talks about the nature of the health insurance market, which I thought would be interesting for us to look at what I thought. And I really urge each of you to look through this book, because my co-chair was kidding about boring, but the fact is it's really fascinating. There, on figure 1-2, it really points out the issue with providing health insurance, and it points out why moving to the health insurance exchange that we've just buried somewhere in a hide-and-go-seek game. It points out the problem is that we have lots of people who are employed in places that under the exchange could get access to health insurance that aren't now. And it's really fascinating to look at the difference between, say, 10 and 20, where about half of the employees are covered, on up to the large groups over 100, where virtually all of them are covered in the large group market. And it's also particularly interesting to look at the same time this happens, to look at figure 1.3 that talks about the growing deductible. We did hear that the average small group plan now has a $2,500 deductible and an 80-20 copay after that. And that's changed just over the 6 years from about a $1,000 deductible in 2004 to a $2,250 deductible in those plans in just 6 years. So the way the small groups up till now have been coping with the extraordinary increase in health insurance is to simply pass back to their employers, to their employees, the cost both in the premium share and in the deductible. So I mean, it's the nature of the health insurance market is essentially moving us towards catastrophic, particularly in the small and medium-sized group markets. And we hope, as we all voted for in this committee, that the exchange will help mitigate some of that expense.
Representative Parrish.
Thanks. And I probably will go home and read this because there's some good information in here. Can I assume from page 6 to 7 and kind of this little section that Representative Greenlick pointed out to us, when we're talking about coverage and employer premiums and the division of that this is all private sector data? This is, of course, employee contribution at 28%. We're not talking anybody who's employed in a county, city, municipality, government job.
Yeah.
No, it's all private sector and what the private sector is picking up and their employees are picking up.
Yeah, co-chairs, Representative Parrish, no, these employers would include both public and private employers, some of whom, public employers, some of whom are insured commercially and many of whom are self-insured and fall into those various categories as any other employer does.
So these are just then, these, I'm looking at figure 1-4, employer contribution being 72%, employee contribution being 28%, and so then that's kind of aggregate across all.
It's an aggregate number.
So feasibly, if you were to kind of lift out public sector, that employee contribution could actually be higher since public sector.
Mm-hmm. No. Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Parrish, that's correct.
Yeah. Isn't paying 28% of their health care costs.
Can I make it clarify?
Yes, please.
This is just a clarifying thing of breaking out public sector. Teachers in Oregon have had to pay out of pocket for 15, 16, 17 years, and it goes every year. So they're paying
out of pocket. I'm just trying to get a sense, though, of 28% out of pocket.
Probably more. Yeah, it could be. So let's make the delineation, because at least part of the public sector has been paying out of pocket for or paying part of the monthly premium for a long time.
And co-chairs and committee members, virtually all participants in healthcare programs, whether they're public or private, are paying co-pays, deductibles, co-insurance, those kinds of things. And those figures would be, this is not just premium contribution, but would be contributions to healthcare costs generally.
This is only premium in this table. That's a very.
Oh, I'm sorry. In
1-4 only says premium.
That's right. But in the general,
issue, different than a copay.
But the table up above, 2,000 is that
for the deductible.
They're paying. Many are paying almost all their costs of health care out of pocket.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Anything else? Well, thank you, and I'm sure we'll have more discussions on this topic. Okay, next up, we have an overview of the Legislative Work Group on Healthcare Worker Influenza Vaccination. Dr. Mel Cohn will bring us up to date, draw a line where we're starting to get ready for 2013. No pressure.
Good afternoon. Co-chairs Thompson, Kenemer, and Greenlick. For the record, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm the director of the Public Health Division and the State Health Officer. Thank you for inviting me to speak with you about this topic today. In my line of work, we have seen over the last 100 years or so a pretty dramatic transition in the health problems that people are facing. It used to be back around 1900 that they were communicable diseases, infectious diseases, and now chronic diseases and injuries, by and large, are what are killing people. But there's one pretty major exception to that change, and that is flu. It has continued to be a major killer. It's in the top 10 every year in Oregon as well as around the country. Patients, when they go to see a healthcare provider, are especially vulnerable to the effects of a flu infection because obviously they're already sick. That's why they're going to see a healthcare provider often. Because the healthcare providers have close contact with patients, they can be a pretty easy source of infection if they themselves are infected. So really, you know, from my standpoint, I don't think anybody should have to be afraid that they're going to pick up the flu when they go to see a healthcare provider or get admitted to the hospital. But really, as a nation, we haven't done a very good job. In fact, it's pretty embarrassing how poorly we've done in getting healthcare workers vaccinated. The data from the Centers for Disease Control last season showed that only about 64% of healthcare workers were vaccinated against the flu. And even during the height of the H1N1 pandemic, when there was so much publicity about this, really the numbers were still quite poor. We do know that workers who worked at facilities where vaccination was required by their employers had higher rates, about 98%.
Can I interrupt you just a minute? Sure. Senator Coyle has a question.
I don't have a handout. Did this come with a handout? Did you bring the handout?
because on the agenda it says overview of the legislative work group on healthcare worker influenza vaccination. And you're giving us an overview of the importance of healthcare vaccinations, which as a public health officer is important, and I understand that's your background, but I just want to be clear, is this an overview of the work group or the findings, and are the findings available, or is this an overview of your perspective on vaccinations in for healthcare workers? Because and that's fine if it is. I just want to know what you're presenting.
Co-Chair Hoyle, other members of the committee.
Vice chair, I'm not. You know, he's
co-vice
chair.
He's
not dead yet.
Long without you before I met you again. Long without you now.
I am going to describe what we've done with this work group in just a moment. I wanted to just make sure that the context for the work group was clear. And I didn't bring a handout with me. If you'd like any written material and follow-up, I'd be happy to provide it for you.
Follow-up. So this is a description of your setting context for why the work group was put together and your perspective on...
Co-Vice Chair, yes. Let me skip then to...
No, it's fine. You can do that. I just want to make sure that we're clear about what you're presenting. And I'm fine. I love it when you come to our committee, and it's great, but I want to be clear about, you know, again, if we're saying we're getting an overview of a legislative work group, there should be an overview. Or you should say, actually, I'm here to present these things, which is also fine. Just want clarity.
Okay. Co-chairs, co-vice chair, thank you. You're very kind. So, you know, we have tracked this issue here in Oregon for some time, and at the request of Senator Morissette, we did put together this work group that really was designed to pull together the partners across the spectrum and see what kind of consensus we could reach about how to approach this problem. I would say that there's unanimous consensus that this is an important problem and one that needs to be addressed, but not so much consensus about the best way to get there. The work group has met a number of times. At this point, we are going to be meeting again, but we haven't yet set a date for that next meeting. There are some items that we do have a statement that we have on our internet site that describes the things that the work group was going to focus on: actively promoting annual flu vaccinations of all Oregon healthcare workers, joining forces to educate workers about the benefits of flu vaccination, monitoring vaccine coverage in hospitals and long-term care facilities, measuring patient safety by a facility's healthcare worker vaccination rate, evaluating healthcare worker concerns about influenza vaccinations in order to improve our communications about safety and efficacy, celebrating institutional and organizational successes through a web-based honor roll, and meeting quarterly to review progress and continue, hopefully, to march forward with this. So we were not...
Please.
Yeah. When was the meeting of the first... What was the date of the first meeting of that group?
I believe it was last spring, but... If I may consult the...
Morissette left the Senate?
2009.
He had the first one in March of 2010, I believe.
Co-Chair Greenlick, March of 2010 is, I believe, when the first meeting was. It was just as Senator Morissette was leaving the Senate. So we were not... although I think there was some... certainly willingness to think about some kinds of legislative recommendations and so forth. We were not officially chartered to, you know, produce something to come back to you with a specific recommendation about this. So that, you know, I think there were some differing expectations about that among the members of the committee. But certainly this is an important issue, and it may be one that this body is going to weigh in on one way or the other. So would be an appropriate venue for discussion about those kinds of issues. I think with that, I will stop and see if there are other questions that any of you have that I can answer.
Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, I guess. I've seen a lot of information about the vaccination rates of healthcare workers, and I don't think I've seen any information, although I've asked for it, about the effectiveness of those vaccinations in reducing patient influenza infections. So, you know, when this work group is doing its work, I hope that the focus will not be on an empty number, which is healthcare worker vaccinations that has no data-driven connection to the outcome that I think we're advocating for here, right, which is reducing patient exposure to the flu, or even more so patient infection by a healthcare worker. And so I heard you refer sort of obliquely to it. I may have missed it in your comments, but this is not a question. It's a request that when you come back with a work product, and certainly you're asking, if you are asking for the ability for a company to mandate that someone stick a needle in their arm and get a vaccination, from my perspective, it had better be driven by a very real, profound public benefit. So, thanks.
Co-chairs, Representative Conger, thank you for that. We will prepare some materials on the science behind that. I do believe that there is some good data to support the idea that vaccinating healthcare workers reduces infections in patients substantially. There's a jump from there to, you know, a mandate, but I think the data that healthcare worker vaccination reduces infection among patients, there is some good data there. So I'll be happy to prepare some information and get it to you.
I would appreciate that. Thanks.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Please.
Follow on. By a rapid calculation without using my calculator, the assumption is if you met quarterly, you could have met about 8 times now. How many times have you met as a group? I mean, is it nearer 8 or is it nearer 2?
It's fewer than 8. Yeah, I think about 4 times. Yeah.
We were assured by, we had a bill before us. I take it you didn't take a stand on that bill, or did you?
Co-chair, no, the agency did not take a stand.
And
we were neutral.
I was assured by the hospitals that you were on the verge of, if we just waited between now and the next session, your work group would produce a legislative concept that would be approved by all the parties involved. Is that, would that be your reading of the situation? Or are we going to have to do something else to get toward that?
Co-Chair Greenlick, it's hard to say. Certainly, I don't think that all of the parties around the table in this work group are in full agreement yet. But I do think that there is some trust building going on and some moving towards consensus. Whether we will be able to get there or not, to propose something as a group. But again, you know, that was not, we didn't agree as a group that we were going to produce a bill that wasn't a specific work product. It could be a work product if the group so chose.
Well, if I may follow.
Please.
I think we want a bill.
Yeah.
And we want one that does something. And if you're saying, no, don't depend on us, then we're going to find a different way to move toward a bill that can get 31-16-1. Not necessarily get consensus. We just need 31-16-1. Should we look somewhere else? Or do you think you have the, or do you want to check back with the group and let us know?
Co-chair, I think it would be appropriate for me to take this back to the group and let you know. I think there's it's at least worth a shot.
I would concur with those remarks. If I were to hazard a guess, I would say there will be a bill in this committee in 2013. As the person who killed the earlier bill because it wasn't quite ready, I'll be pushing pretty hard to get something moving in this direction in 2013. And in individual conversations with a majority of the members of the committee, I would maybe warn you that a mandate bill will not be popular with this committee, so that we maybe want to look at some kind of consensus bill that moves us in a direction but doesn't slam the lid down, unless, of course, you can come back with a whole lot of really good data that that's what needs to be done and nothing else will work. But I would bet you that there's going to be a bill in 2013. If that helps.
I really need to concur with that. I mean, Co-Chair and I and other members have been talking. I find that there is no question about the science that if one gets a flu vaccination, on the average, they will spread the disease to fewer people. I mean, that data are absolutely clear. There isn't any question about that. We don't know how it works when you're in a nursing home with more frail people, although you would think that somebody who shows up in a nursing home with a bunch of frail people with the flu is going to kill several of their patients. Now, I don't understand why any healthcare worker who knows the situation is not going to get protected to protect their patients. I just literally find it hard to understand. So, and we have some facilities, as I remember the data, with maybe 10 or 20% of the workforce vaccinated. I don't know. I really don't.
Co-chairs, I appreciate both of your comments, and I appreciate your interest in this issue. From my perspective, as you can tell from my remarks at the beginning, I do think this is a very important patient safety issue, and one that we've got to figure out how to do a better job on. Questions of, you know, mandates, mandating what, how, who,
yeah.
Those are all very legitimate public safety and public policy discussions, and we'll be doing some work to bring some information back to you.
We need a policy first and a solution maybe second, but mm-hmm. I got emails from a couple of personnel at a couple of different hospitals advising me that they had rules requiring masking for those people who are not immunized that applied to nurses but not to physicians. And I look at that and go, come on, guys, we can do better than this. You know, if we're going to have rules for good public health, then it should be rules that apply to everybody. And otherwise, we have to do something else. But it seems like a lot of what's out there may be a little knee-jerk and not maybe good policy. But anyway, it's not your fault. I realize that.
Well, it isn't my fault, but I do feel that this is something we really need to address, and we'll be working very hard to try to do that together with you.
Could you notify us, too, when you're having those meetings? I'm sure that not everyone will be able to attend because of the geography, but it's a possibility we might be able to get some of our people there to interact.
Co-Chair, absolutely. We would welcome you there.
Thank you. Anything else? Surely you have a final word. The last meeting of this session, and you have nothing to say.
I do have something to say. I especially do, too. I do want to say to the committee that it has been an extraordinary session. We've tackled some very hard things. We've done it in a way that I think this committee is viewed by the co-speakers as the most productive of all the committees around, and except maybe Judiciary, who meets 5 days a week.
Yeah.
But I do want to thank my co-chair for the kind way we've been able to work with each other, and thank all of you for the support. And most of all, to thank the person who's really responsible for anything useful we do around here.
Yeah, right.
Yay. You guys are a challenge.
There has been talk, I understand, in the background about transferring her to some other committees.
Yeah. Oh, goodness,
even leadership recognizes that she's the reason this thing works.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'd just like to thank the entire committee. We come from different backgrounds and whatnot, but we have worked exceptionally well together. I think in a very short session, we've moved the needle forward. And no one ever leaves one of these committees absolutely happy, but I think we've been exemplary. I'm very proud of the work of this committee, and I know it is noticed because people tell us they notice it. So every time my co-speaker and I end up arm wrestling, it's always behind closed doors, and we never air it in public, at least, right?
So. And we always fight to a draw.
That's right, yeah.
And we appreciate that. Makes it easier to serve on the committee.
I really enjoy this committee, and we've got the right mix of people to get it done, and hopefully we can keep a lot of that together next session. But we'll be doing 6 months of work in 6 months, not 6 months of work in 20-some days. Yeah. And no more giant bills in short sessions.
Amen, brother.
We will see each other in May.
Yes.
Okay.
Dates have been enough.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thinking of bills for next session. I mean, many of you have had people come to you already, and it's not too early to start getting concepts
and intern topics.
Yeah.
I have one. Yeah. No, I'll tell you after.
Okay.
Bang that hammer.
Okay. Thanks everybody for your attendance, and
thank you.
Committee for the fine work.
Fine guy.
No.